This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, the business station, is Caroline with news of custodial deaths. As of early June, quite a number of deaths have been recorded already. News reports stating that these detainees had died of natural causes, though some postmortems after established otherwise. Families of the deceased and the public have been shocked and outraged at the rising figures and have demanded that swift action be taken to seriously investigate these deaths. So to discuss this further, we have with us our guest this evening, Stephen Thiru, Vice President of the Malaysian Bar Council, as well as Andrew Koo, Co-Chairperson of the Human Rights Division, I believe, Malaysian Bar Council. Welcome, gentlemen. Good to have you here with us.
Good evening.
Good evening. All right. Now, if you don't mind, let's start with the basics.
With the numbers.
So I said, as of early June, quite a number of deaths have been recorded. From our research, we found been recorded, but I believe you have the updated figures.
It's, I think, 10 deaths in the past 6 months. Mm-hmm. Actually, we've had 4 deaths in the past 3 weeks.
That's right.
All right. And if you go a bit back into history, we've actually come up with 1 death per month since the year 2000.
Hmm.
All right.
Wow.
That's appalling statistics.
Now, how does that other countries? So it gives us some sort of indication. Do we know?
No.
Not sure.
We don't.
Hmm. But I suppose appalling nonetheless. I mean, one death a month. Certainly nothing to be proud of. So let's go with the basics then. Arrests, remand, investigations. So let's just start with that. How are arrests made? And can you tell us what the difference is between detaining somebody and arresting someone?
In terms of arrest, I mean, you have to either be told that you're being arrested, or you have to be told or indicated that, you know, you're not free to be able to leave a particular place. So,
and you require a warrant, I take it?
No, not necessarily. No. I mean, if they, think that you are involved, there's reasonable grounds to believe that you've been involved, or they suspect that you've been involved in the commission of a crime. Mm-hmm. So they can arrest you. Again, I suppose it's a little bit of a play on words sometimes when you say you're detained. The police try to say, oh, you're detained, but you're not arrested.
Mm-hmm.
You
right.
know, we pull you aside, we hold on to you, we may even take you to the police station. But, you know, if you keep asking them, am I being arrested? Either they don't say anything, or they'll say, well, no. But then if you say that, does it mean I can go up and leave?
Mm.
They'll say, no, you can't.
So, but what are your rights once you're arrested?
Okay, one important thing that has just been put in place going back about 2 years. We've established, Malaysia has now a National Legal Aid Foundation.
That's right.
Now, what that means is this. Once a person is arrested, detained, and taken to a police station, even before the police can get to question him, the police are obliged to inform this foundation. And the foundation dispatches a lawyer, who's a volunteer lawyer of the Malaysian Bar, to be present there. So he gets access to legal representation before his question.
Right.
Now, it's interesting that you asked that question, because at least in 2 recent custody, certainly not in the Damindran case, in a case going back a bit earlier, I think, last case, in both cases, the police did not comply with that protocol,
mm-hmm.
which they are obliged to do. If they did, then you'd have at least legal representation. I like to think
mm-hmm.
that with lawyers being present, this something like this would not have happened.
What other rights does this detainee have?
Well, if a lawyer is present, then advise, and if the police go after, well, they're entitled to detain for 24 hours, mm-hmm. after which Section 28 and Section 117 of the CPC, they're entitled to go for an extension of the remand. At least a lawyer will be there to argue against an extension if an extension is not warranted or required.
Mm.
Now, what happens in a situation like what happened where the legal aid wasn't informed? Is there a clear set of guidelines, or I would say punishments, that take place for the police, because you didn't do this and you were in the wrong? Or is enforcement of that still an issue as well?
Well, I think it is still an issue, because there is a particular provision which will allow the police not to allow you to exercise your right to access to legal counsel, and that's basically an exception to the rules, and it's under circumstances where they think that if information were to get out that you'd been arrested, there might be an issue of tampering with evidence or witnesses,
right.
or whether you might want to inform your accomplices and things like that. So that's Section 28, capital A, and that's quite regularly involved invoked by the police to sort of say, well, you know, we're not going to let you do that. And so the question that needs to be asked is, you know, we need to test. And I don't think we've really had a test case yet, sadly. We need to test the ambit of those powers by the police. They've exercised it, and you know, we need a test case to say, you know, what are the parameters for which that can be exercised.
Right, and I'm also assuming it's a case of actually educating the public as well, to know that they have this avenue, that yes. You know, that legal aid must be informed, and there's no two ways about it. Because I guess a lot of people, I mean myself included, if I ever got arrested. God forbid.
I would be there for you. I would be there for you.
Thank you, Caroline. But if I ever got arrested, I wouldn't know that was one of my immediate options.
Yes. You must ask for it. You must ask.
So they're under no obligation to tell you.
Well, I think they are obliged to tell you, all right, but I don't think they would, or they may not.
Right.
But you certainly must ask for it.
Okay.
And then they're obliged to actually inform the foundation to have a lawyer sent.
Okay.
What about things like visitation rights, I suppose, family, that sort of thing?
Well, if you follow the proper procedure and you get arrested, you are allowed to call a lawyer, and you're also allowed to inform a member of your family
mm-hmm.
or, you know, that you've been arrested and where you've been taken to and things like that. So that, I mean, precisely so that people can, you know, immediately respond to your need, perhaps for legal representation, but also then to know that, you know, where you are. And otherwise, you know, you go missing and nobody knows where you are. And that certainly happened in a few cases in the past as well. People say, you know, so-and-so has been arrested and we don't know where he's gone, and mm-hmm. nobody knows any information about that person. So these are some of, we would call it visitation rights, but at least right to be informed about, you know, where that person has been taken to.
Right. Now, in the case of these custodial deaths, I mean, you said there's an average of at least one death a month since the year 2000. That would put the number close to 200, being 2013, or just over 150. Now, what then happens to all of these, I guess, unresolved cases? I mean, first of all, do you know if they were all kind of suspicious, or have some of them been clearly stated as, yep, natural causes, the person had a heart attack because they were gravely ill?
All right, I think you can't come to any generalized conclusion on these deaths. But the point is this. The point is that this is a system that requires fixing, all right? And by and large, what we have done is a band-aid sort of solution. So you have the EAIC that came about. Although the Royal Commission and the Police recommended the IPCMC.
That's right.
All right, which would be an external oversight body over the police. Now, if we had that external oversight body, I would be probably in a position to tell you what happened in all these cases, because they would have got into it. They would have investigated it. There may have been prosecutions on those cases. And we'll all be better off. We would know. And I like to think if we had that put in place, that goes back, 2 years ago, we may not have the kind of statistics that we are looking at today.
Well, we're going to compare what is in place today with what was suggested, the IPCMC, in just a bit. Stay with us. This is BFM 89.9. We're talking about custodial deaths here on the evening edition. Caroline and Uma with you today. Our guest, Stephen Thiru, as well as Andrew Koo this evening. So we're talking about IPCMC versus EAIC. So how exactly do these differ?
All right. The IPMC is intended to be an external oversight body to the police.
That's right. It's the Independent Police Commission and Misconduct Commission, right?
Independent Police Complaints.
Complaints and Misconduct Commission.
Independent oversight body of the police, and with kind of powers which would enable them to investigate, to take action. It's a whole array of powers that they have.
Right.
Even to act without there being a complaint, which we call acting sua motu, on their own accord. So wide array of powers, all right, crafted along the lines of similar organizations in the UK called the Independent Police Complaints and Commission in the UK, in Australia, the New South Wales Ombudsman, certainly in Queensland, Australia as well, the Crime and Misconduct Commission, and a similar IPCMC in Hong Kong. So, right. You know, it's not a creature.
It's not something novel, right?
That we've created overnight. You know?
Yeah.
It's there, all right? So it was meant to be, in that sense, an independent body. We never had that. Instead, what we've got now is the EAIC, which very much powers which are far less than the powers envisaged for the IPCMC. They also do have the power to, on their own accord, look into matters, but it'll show that they have hardly invoked that. The first time they've invoked that power is in the recent Damindran's case.
Right.
All right. They've had about, I think, 120 over complaints over the past 2 years.
Yeah. Right.
And they've taken action on one case.
And of course, the Damindran's case of late, because of the sordid details of that case, which I guess forced them to action, you know, with the ears being stapled and puncture wounds and so on and so forth.
Yeah, according to a report in the Star, in the last 2 years since EAIC started their work, there were already 80 deaths in custody between 2000 and 2004, yet only 6 inquests were actually conducted. Why do you think that is? Do you think that they're lacking in manpower? Is the process flawed in any way?
It is flawed. I think nobody in their right mind will deny that the system is flawed. The statistic that you just quoted from the Star, that mm-hmm. actually was the statistics presented to the Royal Commission
right.
on the Police back in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
That between 2000 and 2004, you had 80 deaths in custody, 80, of which only 6 had an inquest.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't know, you know, what happened in the case of 74 other people. How did they die? Under what circumstances?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, to lawyers, it's very strange for us because there is a specific provision in the Criminal Procedure Code, Section 334, that makes it compulsory for a death in custody to be investigated and for there to be an inquest.
Mm.
And so what I'm saying is that the system is flawed because way back since 2000 until now, and maybe if you do more research going back even beyond that, the government has failed to comply with the law. It has failed to conduct inquests into all these deaths in custody as mandated by the law. So the government itself is breaking the law.
Well, Andrew, it's not just for lawyers, because I guess as a regular Joe, it just sounds very strange and surreal as well. Because first of all, prison, if you will, or a police station is supposed to be a relatively safe place, you would imagine. And so therefore, a death in that circumstance sounds illogical. And then, of course, what's even more illogical is that people are dying and we have absolutely no idea why, and nothing is being done to find out why. And for me, that's the complete no, that just makes no sense at all. So I think, you know, that's the big question on everyone's minds when they read these stories in the newspapers. Yeah. It's like, what's going on? That's why are people dying?
Absolute disconnect there.
Can I just say something? Hmm. I think we must not lose sight of the fact that the EAIC is supposed to look after 18 plus 1 agencies,
yeah.
19 agencies, the plus 1 in the police.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So you can imagine the number of agencies that are under them. And you like to ask then what sort of investigative resources they have.
Do yes. you have, right?
Yeah. They at one time apparently had 10. At the moment, they have 1. Now, how on earth do you?
Sorry, when you say 10, you mean 10 people?
10 investigators.
And now they have 1 investigator. Yeah.
So
one.
Lacking in them.
Which was seconded yes. to them mm-hmm. from the Malaysian Anti-Corruption Commission.
Yes.
You know, so it's not even their own employee, as it were. It's somebody that they had to borrow because they didn't have a sufficient number of
which, to use a popular phrase at the moment, perception-wise in itself,
mm-hmm.
Shows that you aren't actually committed to that job.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think so because, I mean, Stephen was being, a little kind. The Enforcement Agency's Integrity Commission, which is what the AAIC is, in case your listeners don't know the alphabet, is a commission that the government created in lieu of trying to address the IPCMC
issue. Yeah.
In fact, if you know a little bit of history, they first started with an IPCMC. That was a recommendation. Then the government said, no, we don't want to do that. We want to do this thing called the Special Complaints Commission.
Mm.
And that died a death somewhere else. And then eventually they came up with an EAIC. And the problem with the EAIC is that in the law, Section 28, this power to be able to launch investigations of their own accord, the suo moto provision, they seem not to have realized that they had that. You know, so since they started, I mean, there was I was trying to find it specifically, but I couldn't, but there was, an interview with some of the people from the EAIC, and they said, oh, you know, well, we received no complaints, therefore we didn't investigate.
Right. They recently announced the inclusion of a former Bar Council president, actually, Lim Chee Wee, the former Deputy Inspector General of Police as well, Ahmad Jamil, as consultants. Do you think this will make much of a difference?
No, they're not consultants to the EAIC.
Okay.
They've just been actually brought in, or they've been appointed as consultants for the investigations into Dhamendran's death.
Oh, so this particular investigation.
Specific, is an ad hoc kind of thing, right? Just for that, all right?
Right.
But you have actually raised again a very interesting point as to who should be, who should form this commission.
Absolutely.
See, in the envisaged IPCMC, one would think that the commissioners would be professional people, people in the know in this area, and you may have the kind of people you have in the EAIC, perhaps in an advisory capacity, but certainly not as the people who are driving the commission, because they are the ones who should be there, energized to make the changes that's required. Because you see, the IPCMC, in its true form, should not be just looking at your normal complaints about the police not attending to your police report, the police moving you from one police station to another.
Right, exactly.
They'll be looking into things which are endemic, all right? Endemic things like corruption. What's the root of corruption? If indeed there is corruption in the police force, how do you weed it out? How do you distinguish the good from the bad? Because, you know, we must recognize that there are many good police officers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can't use the same brush and tar all of them.
Yeah.
Right? You certainly can't. Now, you need a dedicated commission to do that. So you can't have this one fit for all EAIC. With one investigator handling 18 plus one. And that's really the thrust of the suggestion behind the IPCMC.
All right. We're heading in for the news in just a bit. Do stay with us, talking about custodial deaths here on the Evening Edition. This is BFM 89.9. Good evening. I'm Caroline Oh.
And I am Uma Fagan of K-Pagan.
It's the Evening Edition, and today's menu features death in custody. That's what we're discussing here on the Evening Edition. Our guests today, Stephen Thiru, Vice President of the Malaysian Bar Council, as well as Andrew Koo, Co-Chairperson, also a Malaysian Bar Council, focuses on human rights. So we've talked about IPCMC versus EAIC. Just a quick reminder, EAIC stands for the Enforcement Agency's Integrity Commission, and IPCMC, Independent Police Complaints and Misconduct Commission. So let's bring it down to a more pedestrian level for now. Tell us what happens in a police station, because it's something I always wonder about. I mean, is there a limit to how many policemen are allowed to question a detainee at one time? Are there guidelines? What are the methods?
Yeah.
Well, I think, there are two things that one could say here. Firstly, the police are governed by this thing called the Inspector General's Standing Orders, the IGSO, which are basically the standard operating procedures of the police force. They're officially a secret. So we've never seen them, or we have no access to them.
Right.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Right. They're officially a secret.
Yes.
So even if you ask for them, you won't get them, is the thing.
That's correct.
Okay. Do you know at least what kind of conditions these, say, lockup cells are when the detainees are remanded?
Okay. Then there's the other thing, which is the lockup rules. And these are published rules about what you can expect in a lockup. The fact that you can, say, be allowed to have two showers a day, how many the kind of meals that you have and things like that, and the fact that you cannot, strictly speaking, be questioned from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m.
Right.
You have to be allowed to rest.
And I guess this complies with, general human rights conventions.
These apply to basically the UN standards of minimum standards when it comes to places of detention. So there is some correlation between that. But again, as I said, we don't know for sure what's exactly in the IGSO. So we can't tell you one way or another whether this is included or this is not included.
Safe to say it's not exactly the Hilton.
No, not at all. And we don't know what happens in practice, actually.
Yeah.
Whether there are interrogations happening between 6 p.m. and 6 a.m.
Yeah, but there is the arrest diary, isn't it? The detention diary, which the police are obliged to produce when they go for remand to show what they've done. Within the 24 hours, whether they've actually done investigations or they've just not done anything and they want a remand.
Oh.
In which case, then they may not get a remand because, you know, they ought to have investigated things within the 24 hours.
How detailed are these diaries?
Well, they're meant to be an accurate record of what has been done. So it's I mean, just like a diary. It's not dear diary, I did this and that. But yes, you know, at this time, you know, such and such happened this time. So he was interrogated from this hour to that hour and things like that. So it's supposed to be an account of what you have done with a person that you've arrested, or you know, during the time that you've had him.
And can that be released to the general public or?
Well, I mean, again, as Stephen said, when it comes, if there is an occasion where the police need to go to the magistrate to extend his remand from the initial 24 hours to a subsequent period, then of course, you know, if he is represented by a lawyer, and this is where, you know, representation is an important issue, if he's represented by a lawyer, then one of the things that the lawyer should be doing is to say, well, produce the arrest diary and show us what you've done so far, and you know, and why you think you are justified in asking for a further period of remand.
All right. In your experience, both your experiences, do you find that this is a practice that is adhered to?
The producing of the diary? Yes. Well, we've got a case, I think it was Sivarasa's case a few years ago, when the application to extend the remand failed because the police were not able to produce, I think, the diary in that case.
Right.
So there is sanction and they need to comply with it.
Right. But moving on to the idea of coroner's courts and inquests, I guess. I mean, so there's also the issue of coroner's courts and inquests, but could you explain to us what a coroner's court does?
Okay. I'll let Andrew explain the coroner's court bit because he actually crafted the position paper for the Bar Council.
Right, okay.
So he's our living expert on that. I want to say something about the inquests. Now, the inquests, Andrew mentioned this, 334 of the CPC, is something that is done in the magistrate's court. Now, it's not terribly effective hearing because it's very laborious. It is just one of the many cases that come up in the magistrate's court. And from speaking to criminal lawyers, I am told that it's not even given priority. It may just pop up in an afternoon and then it's adjourned and it takes time. And so it for all intents and purposes, the inquest does not, it's not something that works in our system. All right. What we want would be a dedicated court to conduct or to take on the functions of an inquest. And for that, we've actually asked for the coroner's court. Andrew?
Yeah. So the coroner's court, I mean, generally speaking, as his name suggests, is an inquiry into a death, an inquest into a death, basically to try and ascertain the reasons why a person has met his or her death,
right.
What are the circumstances under which that has occurred. Unfortunately, in our laws, there are a lot of provisions which basically say that a magistrate who's carrying out an inquest into a death can, in some ways, come to a very quick finding without having to investigate by sort of saying, oh, I'm satisfied based on the evidence from the medical officer or the police that, you know, there was no suspicious circumstances in this death and not do further than that. What we had hoped in the coroner's court, and I mean, I've not seen the government's actual proposals, but in our proposals to the government, we basically said that, you know, every death, you know, must come before the coroner's court and it has to be investigated, and you can't just simply get away by saying that, oh well, you know, I don't find any suspicious circumstances, therefore, you know, that's okay. So we want a detailed look at every instance of death under sudden or suspicious circumstances.
Right, but the government has proposed the idea of a permanent coroner's court instead of an ad hoc one, I guess?
That's what we are given to understand today. You know, after, I mean, you know, there we blow our trumpet a little bit. After a lot of persuasion, you know, from the Bar Council, I'm sure other people as well, I think they've seen sense to realise that they do need to address the issue of not just deaths in custody, but also this whole idea that, you know, we need an independent coroner's court, independently established, that will be able to investigate deaths. Right now, magistrates act as coroners. So as and when you have one, you ship someone in, and whoever's there at the time in a particular town or whatever it is, he gets to do it. And so the I suppose the degree of quality of investigations or inquests vary tremendously, because these are not people who are specifically trained to do inquests. So one of the things that we suggested, and I think has been accepted, is right. that you know coroners will be specially trained people who will know what to look for in some ways.
And we see it on
TV. We do not know whether the suggestions or the proposals that we've made are going to be adopted. The expertise, for example, whether they're going to use pathologists or qualified pathologists to assist them in their inquiry. So these things have to be looked into. You know, I think you'll forgive me for the skepticism because we don't want another EAIC in lieu of IPCMC,
right.
A coroner's court, elevated kind of inquest by a magistrate, inexperienced magistrate. And that's the other thing I wanted to mention. When you have these inquests which are done by the magistrates at the moment, these are magistrates who are not experienced in this activation in doing these things. There's no expertise or knowledge or qualification in it. And hence, the inquest procedure is not something that's of any utility at all.
Right. Yeah, but of course, you know, there are two major problems here as well. I mean, there's one is the uninvestigated deaths of those in custodies, and of course, no justice there. But of course, the other thing, and a more practical problem that comes out of this is all of this creates a massive perception problem for the police, and it makes it very difficult for them to carry out their day-to-day jobs as well, because the public at large mistrust them.
Yeah, I think you've touched on a very important point, because we can go to specific like deaths in custody and things like that, but I think what the government, I hope, has finally understood is that, you know, in the big picture of things, you know, what you have is a huge deficit of trust and a lack of confidence
in the entire institution.
You know, we don't see them as being able to police themselves. We feel that over the years, many years now, what has happened is that we've created an environment of, we've allowed to have been created an environment of impunity where people can do things in the police that either their fellow police officers are going to protect them, cover for them, or, you know, and they're not going to get...
Now, I mean, what's the next step? I mean, so the government has proposed this coroner's court, I mean, to begin with, and I guess over the weeks and months that follow, we will see more specifics to that proposal, hopefully. But is the final solution an IPCMC?
Yes, it is. And I think we're going to push for that. I don't think we're going to accept this, as I said, a band-aid of the EAIC as good as they make. The IPCMC is not meant to be a stick to hit the police. All right, let's get that right. Okay, I think the thrust of the IPCMC really is to improve the professionalism of the police, to improve the efficiency of the police, to deal with the systemic problems that are in the force, and we can't run away from that. The facts speak for themselves. All right. So, going by that, there's no way that we are going to. I mean, the Bar Council is not going to back off from having the IPCMC, particularly because we see it functioning very well in other countries, and there's enough empirical evidence to show that it's showing results. It's certainly showing results in Hong Kong.
Right. To ensure that this push for the IPCMC continues, what do you think the role of the media should be? What do you think the role of the public should be?
To continue to remind people of all these unresolved cases. I mean, as we started earlier in this session, when we talked about the fact that, you know, 2000, 2004, you had 80 deaths in custody, only 6 inquests. But, you know, that's a forgotten statistic, you know. But it's not forgotten to, as I said, the 74 families.
Absolutely.
You know, the families with 74 people for whom there's no explanation. And then so you just extrapolate that now, you've got something like 213, 214 deaths in custody since then. And again, the number of inquests, the number of explanations is paltry. And so you have a lot of people out there who are hurting simply because they don't know. There's no closure. And so I think the press needs to continue to highlight that. And it needs to be far more aggressive in terms of questioning ministers and holding them to account. They speak on behalf of the rakyat, of the people, and they have a chance to question ministers during press conferences. They should hold them to account.
Yeah, and I guess that then there's a further regression of that, which brings in the public as well, where the public's job is to pressure the media as well to keep these stories alive. Yes. And yeah, feces flows downhill.
On that note, I think it's time to say thank you to our guests, Stephen as well as Andrew. Thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Thanks.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Just to last line to your readers, or listeners rather. Mm-hmm. The Malaysian Bar website has on it a thing called a red book or red pamphlet, and that actually is a list of the procedures that would happen if you're getting arrested and things like that. So, you know, just go to www.org.my and have a look at the red book. It's on the right hand column down somewhere, and you can download a whole list of what happens to you and what you should do if you're detained or arrested.
So know your rights.
That lists all your rights as well.
Yes.
All right. Very good.
Excellent stuff.
And if you get arrested, YBGK.
YBGK.
The National Legal Aid Foundation.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, gentlemen, for joining us, for sharing your insights. We're wrapping up the evening edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.